Episode 16 of Season 17, Billboard Radiation Pulls Handbrake on Antivirus Jobs. Welcome to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the studio with me is Mr. Miles Elam. We're recording from Los Gatos, California. Hi, Miles.
How's it going?
Quite well, thank you. You've been out-pedented? Is that how you pronounce that?
No, it's not a real made-up word.
During this show, we're going to talk about Handbrake, Facebook stuff, also some automation and jobs, antivirus warnings, billboards with regards to lawmakers. But first, let's do some follow-up. Please do tell us how Glenn de-pedented you? Removed your pedantry throne?
Was the superior pedant.
Thank you.
I had said that there's a lot of that Saturn and Jupiter are highly radioactive. This was not strictly correct.
But what did you mean by that? We were talking about the flybys and stuff and how
Yes, I meant by if you are on a Jovian moon or if you were near the rings of Saturn, that there would be a fair amount of radioactivity coming your way from the planet side.
Okay. Emanating from the planet, and that would infer that life would have trouble with, like, cancer, things of that nature. It would be dangerous.
Well, we would, at any rate.
At least us, yes.
Not necessarily any
other life
alien
forms.
Creatures that may be beyond, underneath a very thick ice crust.
Okay, you know. So you said it was radioactive, and Glenn said, radioactive, caused by or exhibiting radioactivity.
Right, whereas radioactivity is property possessed by some elements such as uranium or isotopes such as carbon-14 of spontaneously emitting energetic particles such as electrons or alpha particles by the disintegration of their atomic nuclei. Now, he was being very specific that there isn't so much the transuranics. Actually, transuranics really don't occur naturally, but there really aren't things like radioactive uranium or cesium or things like that in high concentrations on the gas giants. In fact, the Earth has a higher radioactivity on that count.
Right. Radioactive isotopes that are unstable and break down over their half-life, half of the material gets broken down. That's the whole...
Or it goes to a daughter product, yeah.
Right. And so that kind of material does exist on the rocky planets quite a bit, and Earth has a lot of that. In fact, it's one of the reasons why we still have a molten core, because if we hadn't had that breakdown, that extra energy by nuclear fission happening regularly, we would have cooled down much earlier in the in our evolution of the planet. In fact, the dating of the planet, if you think of it as being a liquid mass at one point, it's slowly cooling. If you calculate that out, you'd get a different age. It'd be a much younger Earth. But because of the radioactive material in the Earth, we stayed hotter for longer.
Yeah, or specifically the decay of uranium-235 to 238, which has a half-life of 4 billion years. Anyway.
So he was saying that actually the Jovians do not have...
Well, Jupiter and Saturn are by far more helium and hydrogen than any other element. A composition very similar to the sun.
But I would assume that you're correct in that they're producing a lot of radiation.
I was incorrect because a lot of that radiation is coming from, for example, with the Earth and the Van Allen belts, it's not radioactivity coming from the planet, from the surface. It is from solar winds and other charged particles in the upper atmosphere that are being directed by the magnetic field.
So we have a strong magnetic field, hence the Northern Lights, but also that's a protective belt from a lot of radiation from the outside the atmosphere.
The magnetic field keeps radiation from bathing the surface and sterilizing it, yes.
So the Jovians don't have that?
They do.
Oh.
They have very strong magnetic fields, and those magnetic fields combine with rotation of the planet and the emissions of the sun, end up with highly charged particles being whipped around at high speeds, and therefore you have a...
unpleasant environment.
Yes, a radioactive environment. Even though the radioactivity is not coming from the planets themselves, it is from, if for lack of a better term, their blanket.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, and we put up the full story from Glenn up on our website for today's show. And the other thing he's talking about is a particle material breaking down and the particles that accelerate off. And a lot of those only have a short range. The other thing to think about
short in the cosmic sense, not short yes. as in you cannot outrun them.
No, of course. But the other aspect about radiation in general and what types there are, it is really important to think about the different types. Like when you are getting x-rayed at a dentist office, it's one of those times when you think about radiation, right? Because they put a heavy metal, most likely lead blanket on you to protect your organs, and then they shoot your head full of x-rays. And those x-rays pass through you. And those x-rays, when they pass through you, can cause damage.
They
hence
do.
The extra blanket.
They do. It's just a question of how much.
Right.
Because the human body can repair a certain amount of damage.
Right. And so that's one type. The other form is material that is actually always causing small bits of breakdown. It's changing its form to a heavier
You're talking
atom
about radio,
to a less atom.
Radioactive decay.
Decay.
So an element, so a plutonium decaying to a... uranium.
Right. And if you ingest that kind of material, if you get that kind of stuff inside you, then you have the situation where you're constantly being radiated by stuff.
Well, that's...
And that can be dangerous at a totally different level because your body doesn't necessarily purge that material from your body.
That is also a different thing because X-rays are energetic photons,
mm-hmm.
Whereas when you have elemental decay or radioactive decay of a particle that's in your body... if you take something like uranium or plutonium, chances are you're talking about a alpha particle.
An alpha particle has enough energy to do what? Why is it?
Well, it's a neutron. So think of it as a helium nucleus mm-hmm. in this case. So without the two electrons.
Or the proton.
No, the proton is... Oh, no, it's... Sorry, a...
A proton?
Nucleus. It's a helium nucleus.
Okay, so it's the... Proton.
Oh, wait, hold on. Yeah, it is charged. Yeah, it's proton and neutron.
Okay.
And that can cause some damage. Then you have beta decay, which is an energetic electron.
Right. And what you're saying is that there's just a lot more energy packed into a larger particle.
You actually have a mass there that can interact as opposed to... And gamma rays would be take X-ray and go a little bit further up the frequency
higher energy
scale.
Level, yeah.
And there you have gamma rays. But they are all a higher energy level than, say, for example,
FM radio or something.
Yeah. Ultraviolet is about where things start becoming ionizing radiation.
Which means it can damage cells. Yeah. Right.
Below that, you have visible light, you have the infrared, you have microwaves, you have radio waves.
And all of those can't actually damage a molecule, if you will. They can't modify a molecule. Except for, of course, visual light can modify molecules if they're set up correctly, hence the ability for plants to take sunlight and make energy from it. Mm-hmm. In any case, I think we covered that pretty well. It's true that those words are a little tricky to use because there's multiple meanings of those.
And I'm sure we'll have to do another correction next week for something we've said.
But another thing kind of sums up is that the Earth is probably more radioactive than Jupiter or Saturn by virtue of being a rocky planet with heavy materials. Anyway, cool. We have another follow-up from a few shows ago, actually from our episode Linux Brick Siri with Fake Tracker. And in that episode, we talked about Dallas security systems, specifically their sirens. Do you recall the story?
Yes.
And that
all the sirens, the weather sirens all across the city went off.
And it was hard to turn them off.
Yeah, at midnight to 2 a.m., somewhere thereabouts.
And Robert emailed us and said, I was just listening to the show about Dallas and had to comment. I work in the wastewater industry, and we use point-to-point radio communication. We use this because our sites have backup generators and or batteries. So even if the phone system or the internet system fails, we can still control remote sites, which, of course, makes complete sense. I'm used to terrestrial links in FM radio as well. That's how normally you send... the signal from the main station up to your towers. Mm-hmm. You use a satellite or a terrestrial link, which are microwave dishes. And that's useful because, again, your telephone is necessary. Those things are a little more rare now than just using the internet, but it does make sense in a situation where you've got remote locations to do something like that. And, of course, he's suggesting for the Dallas system, I would definitely recommend they use an encrypted radio system controlled at a central location. Also makes sense. Clearly, someone either, and we don't know what the Dallas system was. So that's a tricky, right?
Actually, I did find out after the fact that it was radio controlled, but obviously not particularly secure.
Right. Maybe they didn't set up good passwords, or maybe they never did have encryption. The older systems, it was just kind of suggested if you've got the equipment, you can do the thing, right?
Right.
And then the next question he had to do about DOS, denial-of-service attacks, and whether large-scale denial-of-service attacks are feasible. And this is a completely different thing.
Or rather, were they feasible on two particular companies?
Yeah. Ask if you could... Could you do a DDS on Google and Amazon? Now, when we're talking about Google and Amazon, what we're talking about is Google's infrastructure, obviously. But Amazon's, we're talking about Amazon's cloud infrastructure, which all of Netflix is behind. It's a very big infrastructure.
Yeah, which is, I mean, you say it's in the cloud, but it's servers and data centers. It's
I'm just
much
saying
the
cloud
same.
Infrastructure because that's how they sell it. Yeah. But basically, it's their AWS services or AW services.
Yes, I'm fairly sure that. And currently, they cannot take them down. I'm sure many have tried.
So here,
I remember a time when people were angry at Amazon. I believe it was Anonymous that was talking about they were going to organize something and going to try to take on Amazon. And the end result was a bunch of folks going on this IRC channel saying, we're going to need a bigger boat. Because the scale of Google and Amazon are just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Think of how big you think they could possibly be. Not even think how big you think they are, but how big they possibly could be. And I'm pretty sure the number is probably 10 times larger than that.
It's really huge. And this is the aspect about how you do a DOS, right? The whole idea of a traditional DOS. Now, we're talking about a flooding DOS. Sometimes people call a denial of service something where you find a vulnerability on the system. You call that vulnerability causing the system to crash. Now, you are denying the service, right? And the service is not being damaged in the sense that it can be reboot. And every time you hit it, you crash it. And that type of attack is sometimes called a denial of service attack.
No,
but
it is a denial of service
attack. It is, but it's a different level of problem.
It's not a flooding attack, but it is a denial of service attack.
And also, it's not uncommon if you do have a service that you're running that's continually being taken down, that someone's trying to find a hole in the system to then be able to pwn it completely, completely own the system. So when we were having the GeekSpeak site crash regularly, mm-hmm. I was like, oh, I wonder if somebody's probing us and trying to get access. It turned out it was a rogue service that I was running that I had to stop running that service and everything's been fine. So,
in other words, we DOS ourselves.
We DOS ourselves with probably bad configuration of a service that we're running. But in any case...
No, we don't need anyone's help to bring our services
no, we
down.
We can do that ourselves. So, but a flooding DOS, the thing about a flooding system is that you have to basically have enough requests in flight that the system cannot respond to them fast enough. It tries to respond, and it slowly gets overwhelmed by the request and can never handle it and stops responding. Or it responds, but just very slowly, effectively taking it down.
Now, bear in mind, Google responds to like, think of how quickly you're typing stuff in and the suggestions are popping up almost before you pull your finger up off the keys sometime. Like,
which means
it's
that
amazing.
Every keystroke after the second is being sent to them.
Right. So as you're going along, so slowing a system down, let's say you really did try to take on Google and really had a massive botnet that you could bring to bear and were able to do that without real detection or mitigating factors. You were just, slamming the system. What if Google took a full second to respond? Because we're talking about they respond.
Milliseconds.
It depends upon the request, but let's say they responded in 200 milliseconds.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this huge denial of service attack, and instead they respond in 900 milliseconds. From the point of view of a systems engineer, reliability engineer at Google, they're going to be like, whoa, what's going on? This is crazy. From a user standpoint, they're going to be... If you even noticed,
the thing is, from the user's perspective, they're just going to think that something's wrong with their home network.
Yes.
Right? Somebody turned
on
the microwave.
Totally.
People have that kind of problems with the network all the time. So that's one thing. You have to
just,
have a bot.
Just like with this, when Google or Amazon have gone down, it's been because, just like us, they shot themselves in the foot. There was a misconfiguration and it took them off the net.
It's common for that to be a problem.
It has never been the case that I'm aware of that an outside force, whether it be just a group of random hackers, organized crime with a botnet, or a state-sponsored attack has actually taken them offline, for a short time.
So keep in mind, like Google, for example, in peak traffic where people are actually doing a lot of searches and stuff, they are handling billions and billions of transactions. So you have to be at a point where your botnet or your request cycle, if you do traditional you know, per machine does multiple requests. You have to get such that you can go to the point where you're overwhelming, which means you have to have a substantial botnet. But there are other types of attacks that can be cheaper to perform. And I'm thinking of the using the network time servers. In you can actually, there was a vulnerability in network time servers at one point where you could make a request to a network time server, and then the time server itself would make a request back to you, theoretically. But if you falsified the IP address, you could actually get the payloads to be extremely high. So you could actually take advantage of existing systems and multiply out. What actually occurred is the network time servers would crash, or it would be a DOS of the network time servers. But I think at one point there was also a way of doing this with DNS requests, where you use DNS requests, DNS servers to then direct traffic at an IP. Mm-hmm. But so there's other ways to multiply your effect, and that can work. Those things get patched and fixed over time. And then the other aspect of this has to do with what you're actually trying to achieve. If you're trying to achieve Google not working for a region or something, if you've got a lot of machines in that region, you can do that, because regionally it's going to be the domain name is going to return to an IP address of the common space when you're in a common area, partially. And theoretically, in that area, you could overwhelm Google. But to do that, you basically would be taking down the network of that area. So, for example, if you got all the computers at a hotel and you were able to take over all the, the televisions in a hotel to attack Google, the hotel's network would go down. Like, that's where the fall point would be. And that's just a representation of a lot of machines in a bottleneck. That bottleneck kind of exists everywhere. So you're going to do regional damage potentially if your network's high enough density, but you're not going to take them down
right.
globally.
And governments can cut off their country from,
right.
Either physically cut the links, or more likely just say, okay, block all traffic from these IPs. And
IP blocking, of course, is a mitigation strategy that Google is going to use at its boundary layer, as is Amazon. If it's getting pinged and nailed really hard by an IP, it's going to look at the signature of that IP and possibly stop responding to those requests or blocking those IPs.
I was thinking in terms of state-sponsored as opposed to attacking, just to say, I don't want people to be able to see Google. They'll just cut off access, coming into the country from that, as opposed to trying to take Google down.
There are also fundamental issues with IP routing systems, and these are more highly controlled and managed. But when we talk about routing tables and how they work, when it really comes down to it, it's a trust network of individuals that have a lot of management power. And those are vulnerable points as well. And of course, domain name servers are also a pain point. So I'm not saying that those systems, Amazon and Google, are immune to DOS, but traditional, large over-request to DNS over request denial of service is not really gonna, traditional denial of service attacks against them is not really gonna work from a flooding perspective unless you have a giant network. Moving on, Miles, tell me about communicating with lawmakers.
The FCC has been, or the current FCC has been, rather hostile to the notion of net neutrality, pulling back a lot of stuff that's done by both the Obama administration and by the head of the FCC, the previous head of the FCC, that was a Obama appointee.
Mm-hmm.
And Congress voted in March to block the previous FCC privacy rules so that internet service providers could sell users' private data.
And basically, Obama signed into law that they couldn't do that, but never actually...
It wasn't signed into law. It was an FCC directive.
It never actually came into effect yet.
Right. Mm-hmm. It was blocked by the courts almost immediately to take effect. And then the current FCC, with a Republican president, he can appoint the chairman. And the current chairman is very much a FCC is, or the net neutrality is a bad thing. Well, there are some folks by a group called Fight for the Future who have not taken this line down. Mm-hmm. They see this as a fair amount of political corruption being bought off by the telecom industry.
I'd have to agree.
And so they have purchased several billboards.
In D.C.?
Around the country.
Mm-hmm.
These are in the lawmakers' districts of lawmakers who have been paid by the handsomely by the telecom industry and voted to retract net neutrality rules.
Right. Here's one of the there's a photograph, a duotone in blue of Blackburn. I guess she's a
Marsha Blackburn. Yes, she's a representative.
Blackburn betrayed you. She took $497,499 from telecoms. Then she voted to let them sell your web history without your permission. Ask her why, and then they give the phone number, which if she's your representative, the phone number is 615-591-5161. And then the ad is savebroadbandprivacy.org and also paid for by Fight for the Future. That's a pretty damning billboard because no one likes telcos.
But it's also one where someone actually spent the money and really retaliated, which is something that doesn't normally happen, especially with a issue like net neutrality, which most people don't understand, don't know about, and descriptions of it end up being boring. It's another reason why I find it so heartwarming to have someone like John Oliver describe it, which he did again last night. The first time he did it, he was describing net neutrality and did quite well. And the result of that was a flooding of the FCC, where it crashed their server with so many requests for comment. FCC received more comments about net neutrality at the time than it ever received in their history.
Yeah.
On any issue. And so he did it again, talked about net neutrality, talked about the rollback and explained again. And once again, the FCC website crashed.
Unfortunately. I mean, that's not, of course, the intent. The intent is to get the feedback to the system.
Right.
But, you know,
question of whether or not, the question of whether or not it was a malicious, you know, just trying
DOS.
To hammer the system. Yeah. Or that's one possibility. The other possibility is you have enough people who are interested in giving comment and going to the website and
trying to get feedback.
That the FCC website in the comment section really is not a high traffic or high volume.
Right. Yeah.
Portal.
Most of the time they're going to handle, you know, maybe 20 requests a minute, but like that's low. I mean, it's not going to be high in traffic.
Right. So I
and
don't
so
know.
So when you get a million requests a minute, you've got a problem.
Right. So I don't know that it's per se that there was some hacking involved. There may have been as part of it, but I also think that the FCC website is probably fairly brittle with regard to
the
amount of load
coming
in.
The Geekspeak server stays up most of the time unless we take it down accidentally. But if John Oliver mentioned Geekspeak and asked somebody to go there, we'd be dead, like instantaneously. There's no fallover or anything. It'd be just non-responsive. So it's not necessarily...
So whatever you do, John Oliver, if you're listening to our podcast,
that's not
don't mention our show on your air.
So this seems like a pretty... good strategy. You're telling the voters that voted for them, this person did this. The thing that's so interesting about these billboards is it clearly looks like corruption, right? But in the United States, you can get money from people and decide on your voting, and it's never brought up as a corruption issue.
Oh, it is. Although, from a legal standpoint, they refer to it as lobbying. But there's a very fine line between that lobbying and just straight bribery. And this is borne out by various studies. The Princeton study comes immediately to mind, where they refer to the U.S. as being an oligarchy rather than a democracy, because those with the money tend to have their way with the laws that get passed, even in contradiction to the popular will.
Let us move on and tell us about antivirus software.
Yes. Antivirus software is still a thing. a lot of people have actually started reducing their usage of antivirus software simply because systems have become a lot more hardened, and antivirus software has had a reputation, some of it deserved, of slowing the system down tremendously, where you would buy this hot new machine, you get the new operating system, and you have antivirus, and suddenly you have a machine that feels like you bought it in 1992.
And also, we've seen vulnerabilities in antivirus software, where the company, you know, some Trojan or something got in because the antivirus software had a bug.
Right. And this is where it comes in, is that the antivirus software, because it has to install itself at such a low level in the system to watch what's going on, if there are vulnerabilities, it leaves you wide open. And this is what this...
It's interesting, because antivirus software is kind of like a rootkit you installed yourself.
Yes,
because it has to like look at everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Symantec actually had an issue with Microsoft at one point because they were compromising, causing some crashes because they were installing themselves in Ring Zero, but... At any rate, there are companies out there, for example, the German-based firm AV Test, that takes a whole lot of AV software, antivirus software, and checks to see, like, how would it react to these scenarios? And there's always been the test of which antivirus vendors are able to handle the current threats that are on the net, able to detect them and thwart them, clean up existing infections. There's also the question of what happens when there is a zero day, and it's the cat and mouse, mm-hmm. because many antivirus creators, or sorry, many virus creators will actually test their software on antivirus products first to see if they get caught and tweak it a little bit until they don't get caught, so they know that their first iteration will get through.
Of course.
But what hasn't been checked as often is whether or not the antivirus software itself would fall victim to known flaws. And so
what do you mean?
There are various things that you can do to prevent your system from your a binary, a random program or library to be taken over. On many modern operating systems, you have something called address space layout randomization, which is when a program runs on each computer, and actually depending upon the each run of a program, the memory space where a particular function is loaded, you know, where in memory, mm-hmm. those addresses change. And it's also especially important on a 64-bit system because you can then assign memory addresses that are very far apart, far much more so than a 32-bit address, which allows only, theoretically, up to 4 gigabytes of area. Less than that because the operating system takes up some and some overhead. But with 64 bits, you're talking about such a large number that just scanning memory doesn't work anymore.
Right,
and you
right.
can actually have some space in between where things get loaded or virtual
sure.
memory. The other is a data execution prevention. This is usually handled within the processor itself, but
this
also
is basically kind of declaring some regions as executable and some regions as non-executable.
More specifically, everything is executable until you say this is setting the non-execute bit on the processor, and this is not available.
So you can do things like if you're loading an image into memory, you can say this whole region right here that's this image is non-executable.
Right. The idea being that it would be text data. If
yeah.
you're loading some data
or
from a web page, yeah, you wanted something that's data that you act upon but is not executable data. It's not part of the flow of if, then, else.
And what that does, what that achieves is that if someone is able to put malicious data inside your – malicious code inside your data area – and then redirect your with some kind of bug, redirect your execution path to that point, the processor will go, oh, no, you said you could never execute from here, so no, you can't do that. It's a legal operation.
Right. And then you have things like digital signatures.
Right. You sign just like you'd sign a HTTPS communication. You'd sign this whole bit of code saying, this thing hasn't changed. And then before the processor does anything, it checks the signature to see if the code is exactly matching.
Right. You see this often with the Windows Store and the Apple Store for Macs, where when you download a program or when you try to run a program, it'll say this is not signed by Apple. And for most people, that's the end of the story.
Right.
On Windows, much the same thing, saying, hey, this isn't signed. I'm not going to run it. Unless you go into a configuration, you say, okay, I want to say I want an exception if I say it's okay. Or,
right.
you know, you do a temporary, you know, whitelist.
The iOS flow for running on iPhones and iPads, I have to deal with signing all the time because, of course, for us to publish to the App Store, the Netflix application, or for us to make custom builds onto our devices, we have to get a signing authority from Apple to do those things. And that requires quite a few hops and tricks, and it's a constant kind of developer pain. Security is always less convenient, right? The tools are pretty great, but definitely a requirement of signing the code before it runs.
If you're an independent developer, it's $100 a year.
Yep.
Although Windows is cheaper than that, I think.
I think so. To be on the iOS developers, $100 a year. I do that myself, and I've never actually released a private app, though I've built a couple. I just never found the need to share them.
Yeah, globally. I actually have as well, and I keep meaning to, and then I...
You've paid for it, too?
I have.
Dude, we should, like, pay for, like, a GeekSpeak license. At least then we can cut the cost down. I am going to WWDC this year, which I'm kind of excited about. I got a ticket. It's a lottery process, and they're doing it in San Jose this time instead of San Francisco.
Yeah. It's another reason to have a developer account.
Yes, you do get to pay for that. Well, of course, that's through work. I wouldn't do that personally because, you know, I don't make money from the App Store directly. But we get to go to conferences like that.
What I mean, though, is the lottery. You would never ever win the lottery without having paid for the ticket, as it were.
That's right. If you are an iOS developer, you listen to the show, and you want to ask me anything about the conference or, you know, if you're going to be there, you want to meet me, that'd be cool. Let me know. You can email us. We're geeks@geekspeak.org. Also, I'm on Twitter as L-Y-L-E, and Miles is on Twitter
as Miles Elam.
You don't want to spell out Elam?
E-L-A-M.
In just a minute, we're going to continue this conversation about the antivirus software and what actually happened. But first, hey, Miles, you know what we're doing in June?
We are having a live show.
We are doing a live show in Ben Lomond, California. If you are in the Santa Cruz area or even the Silicon Valley area, please do join us. You can find out tickets and all the stuff about all the things at live.geekspeak.org. We'd love you to come. We're doing free tickets, actually. You can just come. But we want you to go sign up so we know how many people are coming so we can buy enough wine and beer and snacks for people. And this is just kind of a once-a-year thing now we're going to start doing where we get to meet and greet you. So if you're in the area, please do meet and greet us. We'll do a normal show on stage with mics so you can hear it. And afterwards, we'll do Q&A. You can ask us anything. We will probably air most of that, or put most of that on podcast, I should say. And so please do join us. And if you've got suggestions and ideas for that show, or if you'd like to share something about some geekiness, please let me know beforehand so I can put you on mic a little bit and you can say hi to the audience. This is a fundraiser for Park Hall, the community building that I help manage. Okay, Miles, now tell us more. What happened with this antivirus software?
So the company put 19 antivirus suites, you know, your Kaspersky's, your Symantecs, your, you know,
all the ones.
And on and on. Mm-hmm. And found that only 3 of them seem to be well protected from savvy hackers.
So the software itself that was supposed to protect your machine from hacking, most of them were vulnerable to hacking. How many did they actually test?
19.
That's not a very, I mean, 3 out of 19, that's not very good.
No, it's not very good.
Well, and what are the ones that won?
Well, you need to go to the website and look it up.
Geekspeak.org. You want to learn more, jerk.
Now, that said, this is interesting to me because I also think of, we've talked about Pwn to Own in the past,
sure.
the browser competition, browser and system competition, and browsers being extremely complex pieces of software. And yet there have been years where a particular browser manufacturer doesn't get pwned.
Yeah.
And it makes me
hacked into, taken advantage of the software.
Right.
Yeah.
And it makes me think of this here, where antivirus software, you would think that would be where you would not want to get hacked. They should have a better track record than the browsers do.
Yeah, but I mean, I wouldn't say they're as complicated as a browser, but they're very complicated pieces of software.
They are complicated, but they are nowhere near as complex.
No. Well,
they don't have as much money behind them as browsers.
What are the So you really suggest that people go to the site? Come on, tell us what the 3 are.
No, go to the site.
All right, geekspeak.org. Thanks, Miles, for that. You have a story about automation and jobs. We've talked a little bit about bricklaying robots. We've talked about potential of algorithms that are good enough to be creative, taking over the roles of human intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
What's this story about?
This story is that a group of economists have gotten together.
Of what? Economists?
Economists.
Okay.
And more specifically, a group from Ball State University, where they were looking at where is automation going to hit the hardest.
That makes sense.
And it isn't necessarily where you think.
Like, well, I would think it would be driving vehicle, you know, like a trucking industry. But what do they say?
That is possible. I was thinking geographic area.
Oh, physical area. Okay.
Yeah. And many people might think of what's derisively referred to as the Rust Belt. So you're
the old
Michigan,
factories.
Yeah. Areas. It turns out they've already done a whole lot of automation.
Yeah, that's why they're rusting.
Yeah. So they're only looking at about 13% of manufacturing job losses.
Well, the thing, I don't understand this. Like, we...
Oh, I'm sorry. 13% are due to trade, the rest to automation. Mm-hmm. They do have a fair amount of losses, but they've already been hit, as it were.
And the farming industry has been hit in most farm. Like, that's why we have cheap corn, for example. That's completely machines. I mean, humans, of course, are driving them, but the amount of labor it used to be. And then there's some still labor-intensive farms. So is that one of those areas where strawberry picking, for example, is going to be automated at some point and effective?
Actually, that's not what they're saying. They're saying that the biggest losses are going to be the large American metropolitan areas. So not your rural areas like you have for farming and for manufacture. Oh,
so now that we're doing more intellect-based automation, that kind of job is in the city?
Well, not necessarily. It may be the driving jobs, but many service jobs may go may switch over. Like fast food restaurants have been talking about for some time, like getting rid of all the people there. You flip the burger, you know, automatically. Yeah. You put it into a package and then you ship it up to the front, you know, or you have someone who just does that. So,
and you give people a good iPhone app to order, and you're done.
Right, and so they're talking about, you know, 65% of jobs in Las Vegas, 63% of jobs in Riverside to be automatable by 2025.
That's pretty soon. Why Riverside? Just as an example of a city?
Just examples of these populated areas.
Making food, like robotic-type food manufacturing replacement, and fast food does seem like to be the place for that. What other areas? Do they have other examples? I mean, the other thing about cities is that cities do change quite a bit over time. Like, at one point, there was a lot more mail delivery during the day kind of services. They still exist, but, you know, email kind of replaces that need in a lot of ways.
Well, they talked about...
Not that it's, of course, an automation
They were looking
process.
At a spread of 700 common jobs, or this is looking at an Oxford University, and they were looking at that. And then they were looking... The economists in charge of this study, Carl Benedict Frey and Michael A. Osborne, were suggesting / predicting that 47% of total U.S. employment
could be affected.
Yeah, could be susceptible to automation within the next decade or two.
So then they just took all the jobs and they mapped what their thought of likelihood of them being automated, and then they concentrated on where those would be, and they'd be cities.
Right. The biggest ones that they found in terms of threat were telemarketers, insurance underwriters and appraisers, tax preparers, cashiers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Now, at the same time, they also looked at jobs that weren't going to go away anytime soon, that weren't going to be replaced by robots or AI.
I've got a son in high school, and my daughter's in middle school, so what can I tell them to study?
Health and substance abuse social workers.
Uh-huh.
You know, that high-paying area. Oh, wait.
Well, it's not high-paying, but as everybody's jobs are replaced by machines, there'll be more need for social work.
There is. It's a question of whether or not we prioritize it as a nation. That's what we haven't thus far. Oral surgeons, choreographers, and just general physicians are protected industries. You go into one of those areas, chances are you're going to have...
Especially
still
as
have
they
a
move,
job.
Even if like the intense skills get replaced by robots, like maybe suture work or whatever, there still needs to be a doctor running that machine.
In theory.
Yeah. Well, I mean, from a legal perspective, we'll make sure that doctors are controlling robots that do surgery for a long time. Even if the surgery's, you know, even if the doctor's doing nothing but looking, you'll still get paid watching.
Yeah.
Choreographies. I love that you threw choreography in there. Speaking of a low-paying job, unless, of course, you're a celeb, and then you make a lot of money doing that. But there's not a lot of people doing make a lot of money off that.
Yep.
Interesting. So think about that, young people that are looking for career decisions. What about software development? How risky is it? All right. Shall we move on?
Well, they did say that, you know, what you expect from the jobs in Silicon Valley, North Carolina's Research Triangle, the Boston area, that these are jobs that are considered by their study more creative and require more social intelligence and therefore are more difficult to just automate away.
Software development requires social skills?
If you're doing it right.
I spent all day talking with people and working on stuff with people. So, yeah, I totally
agree. The company, definitely within software engineering, social skills, what they call soft skills, definitely.
There's a great colleague of mine who's been on maternity leave for a while, and he's back right now. And today he just came to talk about a few different things. You know, he just kind of followed up on a bug thing that I'd caused, a bad one. And I did fix it by the time everybody else detected it, but it was not good. It almost went live. And he was, you know, chatting with me about what that was, and I said, oh, we should change this protocol, and it would be, you know, I need to do this, and that's why I did it, and kind of explain that kind of stuff. We talked through it, and then he brought up something else, then he brought up something else, and all of it was just he and I kind of touching base. We're two different platform teams, right? We're two different teams, and so we talk a lot because I work on his platform, and I, you know, he doesn't like me breaking his platform kind of thing. But so we chatted a lot about it, and I realized, like, after, you know, half an hour of talking, we were just doing social stuff but also talking about the code at a deep level. And it's really that situation that if we do that regularly, then when something comes up, it's a lot easier to manage. I know how he communicates. He knows how I communicate. He knows what we're working on. Yeah, social is really important in software development. All right,
let's move on
to Handbrake. Handbrake is a piece of software that's existed for a long time that allows you to get rid of those really annoying digital rights management stuff on your products.
Actually, no. There's a library called LibDVD CSS. So the CSS is the content security system.
The hack that got DVD
encryption. Handbrake does not include that. You have to download that separately.
Oh, really? I don't think I've ever noticed that.
So Handbrake would only... It didn't used to.
Yeah.
But Handbrake currently will only, what they call rip a CD or rip a DVD after you've downloaded that separate library, or if the DVD is unencrypted, doesn't have that CSS encryption on it.
So I've used this before because it used to be that I'd make my home videos and I'd save and make a DVD out of them, and then I want to play them on a DVD player. And that was great until I don't have any DVD players anymore. And actually, we have one old busted Mac, like the one in front of you.
You don't even have a Blu-ray player or anything like that?
I've got a...
I asked the person who works for Netflix.
I have a Blu-ray player, but it's not connected to any kind of... But also, it doesn't matter. Like, I don't want my movies on spinning discs that slowly get less and less accessible. Like, how does it help me at all to have it on a DVD? Okay, it's time to watch a movie. Let's try to find a DVD player. No. But also, I've bought DVDs in the past, and I don't have a player for them. So... what you use for this is Handbrake. It's great. You throw the disc in and you push a button and it goes through the entire disc and pulls things off. It'll even actually create a system that allows you to kind of see the extras, like the video extras and stuff, in multiple tracks, which is pretty cool.
Of course, great. Sounds great. And so it's...
Well, I want to talk about the downside of that. But okay, go ahead.
Well,
we'll talk
I was just thinking,
afterwards.
Like, that's actually why I got it about a week ago,
mm-hmm.
was I have a DVD.
Bad
yes.
timing, dude.
Yes, I was planning on ripping a DVD, breaking the encryption. At the same time, it's a DVD that I own.
Mm-hmm.
It's one that I wanted to be able to see more than just I've had the player.
I don't judge you, man.
Just saying. And as it turns out, during that window of time that I was downloading this program, a Handbrake mirror server, in other words, where you download the software from, was compromised. And a Trojan was installed.
On your machine?
No, onto the server. But it was one of two servers. So you had about a 50% chance of getting the Trojan.
Okay, so mirrors, when you're doing the downloads, just like a denial of service attack, having a lot of people download something from one location means the machine is going to slowly run out of bandwidth and run out of and have trouble with disk drive space. And so you do this by making multiple copies of these systems. And this cheap way to do that is called mirroring. And basically, the software development company says, here's the software, and then other people copy it onto their machines, and they say, this is a mirror of their machine. And then you just get the most recent one. And sometimes you'll see software that says mirror, and or you'll see like a multiple links. You have to choose one. Sometimes it'll be randomly chosen for you. But the problem is that these machines are... not necessarily as secure as the primary machine, and someone can hack into them and modify the payload, and that's what happened. And did you didn't get the bad payload?
And so I had to check with a SHA-1 and SHA-256 SUM, and in a panic, I'm like, oh, darn it.
So you found out about this after you downloaded it or after
yes.
you ran it?
After I ran it.
After you ran it. Okay. So
after
then
I downloaded it, after I ran it, I ripped it. A few days later, I see the news story and go, oh. Wait
so,
a second.
Okay, so
anything
Miles,
downloaded between May 2nd to May 6th and...
And Miles, you trust the SHA that your computer told you it was?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so here's the thing about that, though. As soon as a machine is compromised, if the software is good enough, it would just go ahead and download the real one, replace the one that you installed with the real one, and you would not know, be the wiser. The SHA would work and everything.
That's true, which is why I installed it onto a virtual machine of Ubuntu. And then double check the SHA was working there. I actually did that. I actually was that paranoid.
Wait, how do you install a copy of it? Where?
Because Ubuntu was already installed in a virtual. So I copied it over.
So you're trusting the main machine not to modify the virtual?
Yes. It's just, as a matter of fact, the amount of complexity required for a Trojan to be able to know all avenues, all possibilities, every virtual machine software.
You're just assuming that the person that wrote that Trojan didn't spend the time to do that extra work. I agree. That's a very valid idea. Over time, that will not be a hard thing to achieve. Like these Trojan kits get more and more complex over time.
Yeah, but if they're getting that complex to handle that many targets, that
you
means they,
well
get they get larger.
That's
and
true.
Therefore much easier to detect.
Yes.
You
yes.
want to have a Trojan be as close and to the original, both in size and behavior, that the person doesn't notice that they have a Trojan running. And as it turns out, I don't have the Trojan. I breathe a sigh of relief.
As
and then
far
I'm
as
like,
you know.
Wow, I dodged a bullet there.
Yeah, dude.
And went, wow, okay, so I would have to check the SHA-1 hash on every single, or the SHA-256 hash on everything that I download. Man, am I really going to do that? And I have to ask myself, am I really going to go through that trouble? Because I have been complacent now.
I've downloaded stuff and checked the SHA, and sometimes I download stuff and don't check the SHA. But when you get, like, a mirror, and the mirror is running ads, I check the SHA.
It wasn't. I went to the Handbrake site and I clicked on the link to download, and that's
there wasn't
where it was
like one of those big like download now.
No. It was the Handbrake site. It wasn't a like switch over to SourceForge or something like that.
So to be clear, the Handbrake site is HTTPS, and next to the link to go get the file, it says this is the SHA that the file should be, and so you can trust the SHA unless, of course, that server is unless their server is compromised, in which case, good luck. Hopefully it isn't.
Or assuming that the web server and the file server are both compromised.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Which is a good reason to keep them separate. Yeah.
Well, of course, if the main web server is compromised, the mirror doesn't have to be compromised because the main web server can send you to a compromised mirror. Like,
true.
It doesn't have to be the real file. All right. Talk about Facebook time? Let's talk about Facebook.
Sure. This kind of dovetails in with the talks about automation and people having some realistic anxiety about their future prospects for employment and being able to get the money necessary to pay rent.
Do you have that anxiety?
I do indeed. Hmm. Now, this comes into play because it turns out that interns at Facebook and Google and Bloomberg and BlackRock,
big companies,
so tech
that
and
have
finance interns are just interns, not the full-time employees.
But the paid interns,
right? Earn more per month than the average American. Someone just starting off in their field with almost no experience, which is why they're interning.
By definition, no experience.
Are making more than the average American who may be halfway through.
What is
the average
American salary?
The average American, now I have to look this up. I don't have it off the top of my head.
I'm using Bing. Average American
salary. $51,350 a year or $4,279 a month.
Average American salary in 2016, the average American monthly salary was $3,769 in 2011. This was equivalent to the average of $45,000 per year. So that was 2011. And now what is it?
It says $51,350 or $4,279. Mm-hmm. That's the average full-time working American. Microsoft interns are second place, making an average of $7,100 per month.
That's like double.
No, but not quite.
Not quite, but that's a lot.
That's a lot more, though.
So how much is that a year?
That's $85,000. Or somewhere thereabouts.
Okay, so that's good.
Number two.
That's good money.
Number one is Facebook.
Wait, but that's somebody graduating from college in probably computer science or something of the equivalent and being an intern.
That assumes that they are out of college. Some interns get paid, they take a summer internship. They're still in college.
Wow.
Facebook is number one. Facebook is $8,000 a month.
Whoa.
So in other words, $96,000 a year for an intern.
Almost $100,000 a year for an intern position.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So you can pay off your student loans in like 7 or 8 years. That's kind of shocking that it's so high. I wouldn't necessarily say it's a bubble, But there's a lot of money in tech.
I do think that there is something of a bubble, especially with the ad industry. I think the ad industry is largely fraudulent with regard to prices right now. That they are very much working on a model of predictive, how someone's going to be, rather than determinative. So there is a lot of hand-waving going on when they try to figure out where ads are going to go. And I don't know if you have experienced this or not, but if I have been on Hulu, I saw this a lot before I stopped going there, where you'd see the same commercial over and over again. Where literally there'd be a commercial break and I'd see the exact same commercial three times.
And I have to
and
say,
then go back to the show.
I told him that experience. I did see that when I was testing out Hulu. I, of course, work at Netflix. I don't watch Hulu. I might watch Hulu if I think of it. But those ads were so irritating that I promised myself I wouldn't use those companies.
Right.
Like, that's how irritating they were.
And the reason behind it was that Hulu, for the advertising deal, had said, we're going to give you this many ad impressions. If they don't have enough viewers to spread out those ad impressions to satisfy their contract, which is going to give them a boatload of money, they have to fill up that space. Yeah. So they put three of the same thing right back to back.
So, by the way, Glassdoor, which is like a site that kind of tells you ratings and things for employment, it's used for software engineer people all the time. I just searched for average software engineer salary. And they say the national average is $95,000. So that's for a software engineer. And in San Jose area, the average is $110,000 a year. So if Facebook is paying the interns the average, or a little bit low the San Jose average, that seems to be a little high. Or are Facebook and Microsoft just paying really, really well?
They're paying well.
So they must get the top-notch performers.
Well, internships, yes, are going to be competitive. They usually have something that they've been working on, some expertise, so they're seeking them out. They're also banking on the future. If you can get people while they're just coming out of college, for example, then you can weed out which ones you want to keep in the long term. But then that person who's just coming out of college, Microsoft used to do this all the time in the 90s, that person just coming out of college, it's the only business environment they've ever worked in.
Right.
And as such, they become part of that culture and much more loyal to the company than someone who has worked several other places and then showed up.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, it's pretty impressive. I guess we're in a good industry, Miles.
Now, speaking of Facebook, while the behavior with interns may be this way, there's a study that came out of Facebook, actually, where a woman engineer tried to tally what the experience of women within the engineering of Facebook, the experience that they're in. And one of those ways you can really see the difference is in a objective way or reasonably objective way is through code reviews.
So when I make a change to the Netflix iOS application, I make all my changes ready to go and kind of as a feature or a new thing that I'm adding in. Did this recently. And I take that and I submit up to a repository and then I ask my colleagues from different teams and stuff that kind of know what I'm doing, I ask them to look at my code. So everything that I potentially could make a change, everything that's being changed, they can look through. And during that process, if they don't understand something or if I've made a mistake, they'll make comments. And that process allows me to make the code better, but also for them to kind of have partial ownership on the code. And that process basically is, it's not very structured here. It's pretty loose. Like Google, it's very structured, of course. But that process does allow you to have better collaboration and better trust in the code. And it's just kind of like people making comments.
Code reviews in general are excellent for, one, someone finding all the WTFs in your code to go, wait, what are you doing there?
Right, right.
To find out if your code is not adequately documented or clear to say, like, wait, I have no idea what's going on, which is a huge red flag because one of the biggest issues with software is maintenance, not the initial
writing. I might make a property name that seems to make sense and someone else says, what? Like, I recently made a property that saved a default value for time, but I didn't specify the type of time it was. And he just said, add milliseconds, you know, add MS to the end of this. I'm like, oh, okay. So I added MS to the end of the concept.
And that's the other thing is the people who are reading your code, it makes them conscious of what your code is doing.
Right. Okay. So what'd she do the report on? What'd she do?
So she was looking to see how often the code was rejected, you know, like saying this is unacceptable, this needs to go back for review, something like that. Looking at all of the body of code that's out there and checking to see was a submitter male or female and what is the response that way. And what they found was that a woman's engineer's code was rejected more often than a man's was. Mm-hmm. Now, the question there becomes, are you going to take the one road to say, oh, well, maybe women just aren't as good at coders? Or do you say, wait a second, no.
There's a bias.
There is a bias there. And especially because the workforce is just 33% female, women just being 17% of the technical roles.
Now, as I recall, this article mentioned that Facebook then kind of said, no, this wasn't done right. Like there was a public response.
There was a public response, and the public response, I thought, was extremely tone deaf. It was saying that by releasing this information outside of Facebook, in other words, not just releasing it for internal consumption to figure out what we're going to do, but releasing it so that the outside world could see it, was hurting the brand with regard to recruiting and retaining women at Facebook as engineers. And it is very much a tone deaf response to say, wait, your big concern is that your brand is being hurt, not your actual employees.
Right.
You know, your brand is hurt with potential employees sometime in the future.
It seems like that response makes it worse in every way.
Yes, it does. This was performed by what is now a former Facebook engineer. I think she left. I did not think she was fired because of this. I think this was she left. And it's been said it's a, quote, incomplete data set. Now, we do work with incomplete data sets. That's predictive statistics. That's what you do. You don't have the complete data set. So I don't know that you can really just dismiss it out of hand just because it's incomplete.
Right.
There was also a statement that I thought was also tone deaf. Quote, any meaningful discrepancy based upon the complete data is clearly attributable not to gender but to seniority of the employee. This brought up a very interesting point, which was there is a not as well documented as it should be, but there is some evidence that when women are hired, even if they have the same GPA, if they have the same experience level as a man, the man is more likely to be brought in at a senior role than the woman. The woman may be brought in at a junior role more often.
And this partially equates to why the percentage of pay is worse for women as well.
Right.
That, you know, if you look at their roles, they're the same, but they get paid better and they have better positions potentially.
But also changes the dynamics with regard to code reviews. The expectations
Absolutely.
That you have, the expectations not just of what skill level should be, but the expectation of finding errors. And from my non-scientific gathering from watching Twitter feeds of people discussing this,
sure.
There is a fair number of stories of people coming in saying, yeah, I'm a woman and constantly I see men who don't have as much experience as me being hired on in a senior software development role above me or something like that. And that's a general thing, a general view of when you have that interview process, that's many times where you decide where's the placement for this person and deciding, oh, well, there we go. This person, based upon your expectations, and these companies are mostly male, the expectations are like, oh, this guy seems like he's higher up. Oh, she seems like she's competent, but maybe she should start at a junior level and work her way up. We've heard stories of Uber as well, but this is across technical fields of women describing a difficulty in getting those promotions, irrespective of their work performance.
Let's assume that her initial analysis was right on the money. And let's assume also that you could do something where finding bugs later or something could equate to quantifying the quality of the code. And you'll find a neutrality there where just as much percentage-wise, just as much code from women and men have the same amount of bugs. And so there's no like obvious flaw of, oh my gosh, there's actually the female engineers that have been hired are not as good. You know, that's just blow that out of the water by looking at the code. So you'd probably be able to analyze this well. If Facebook looked at this effectively, like they do a lot of data analysis, they can see this. So then what do they do? Let's say they actually go, yep, it's true. Women have more judgment of their code than male counterparts. What do you do to fix that? Because from a software engineering perspective, you could potentially start putting in hints, you know. So a man starts doing a review of a woman's code, and up comes a little dialogue going, hey, if this was Jack writing this code, would you be saying the same thing?
Yeah, I don't know that that would work.
Well, I don't know either. I know there's a lot of complexity.
There's very much an implicit bias there that even if you know, for example, I mean, in society, psychologists have seen this over and over again. Even if you know that you might have a tendency to be sexist, if you have a pre-existing notion of that you're not a bad person, you may, instead of change your behavior to be less sexist or less racist, whatever, you
get defensive.
Well, no, not necessarily. You rationalize it in different ways. You find a reason why you right. believe a certain way.
Because the truth is, the way we think is so much a part of our of who we are and where we come from that we can't look at how we think. It's true. At the same time, I think as you start becoming aware of your own bias, if you start training yourself to be looking at it, you can start being aware of it. A great example of this, great example of this is, you know, the first time you saw like an optical illusion someone showed you, you're like, no way, and you really like crazy freaked out. And then the next time you saw one, and the next time one, eventually you see someone says, hey, look at this. What color do you look at? You go, I know that I'm supposed to say that that's the dark square and that's the light square, but I know that the square is the same color.
Except
because you've trained yourself over time to see that you have a flaw in that way. So the more we the more we show ourselves our bias, the more potential we have to learn from our bias and compensate for it.
Except there are things such as inattention blindness. And
I'm sorry, what did you say? I wasn't listening.
Inattention blindness.
What does that mean?
And this is how, for example, card tricks are done. This is how magic tricks in general mm-hmm. are done. This is how people are able to do pickpocketing very easily.
A great example of the video of people playing basketball, and you're asked, how many times is the basketball bounced? And then afterwards, people give these numbers. You go, great. Did you also notice this other thing that happened in that scene?
Yeah, did you also notice the guy in the gorilla suit walking
and
through?
And no one sees it. Yeah.
Right. And that doesn't go away. That is part of our biology.
Yeah.
So you can start to see the scenario and you can kind of catch it sometimes if you're really paying attention. But in general, our day-to-day life, that stays with us.
Yeah, but Miles, if there's software that while the gorilla's on the scene, a big pink giant box covers up the basketball completely and says gorilla in the scene and then goes away, you will go, oh, there was a gorilla. Like, software can help you with these things. You can be trained to start being more aware. You're right. You will always look at the two squares, the one, you know, the square that's supposed to be dark, the square that's supposed to be light, and really they're the same color. You will always see different colors with your eyes. But over time, you can go, wait, oh, there's a problem here. My bias, you know, I have something wrong with my bias system, and that's why I'm seeing it that way.
Right. But that example with the guy in the gorilla suit in the midst of the bouncing basketballs, after the fact, you can point out where you made the error.
Mm-hmm.
But the next time someone has something going on in the background,
yes,
where you're having your focus, you will still fail.
You will still fail. But if software is running on top of that screen that then flashes a pink, odd creature there because another AI is helping you, then you will see it. Like, that's what I'm saying is we can compensate part of the – so, for example, if every time I do code reviews, I am reminded, hey, you have a bias against female engineers, or the names of the engineers are hidden. Or randomized. Potentially, you could help compensate for that.
Except that the engineers who would most be helped by this, or the engineers that should be helped by this the most, are the ones least likely to pay attention to that message going by.
Because the stronger your bias is ingrained in you, the harder it is to change it.
Well,
I totally agree with that.
There's that. There's also that aspect of that message that comes up every single time. You're going to have the same effect that you have from Windows when an alert box came up every single time. You click it to get rid of it.
I get what you're saying, but keep in mind that the goal here as an individual is to be better at what your job is. And your job is not to be a biased jerk. Your job is to be a functional member of the software development team. So if your system is saying, hey, you're being biased, or be careful not to be biased, and then later it's clear you were being biased over time, then you get demoted. You get a pay cut. You get fired. Because you're not doing your job of getting rid of your bias. Your job is not to be, you know, perfectly non-biased because you're a human being. But your job is to start compensating for that and being aware of it.
But you're bringing a different dimension. It's not about giving the message to the person who is trying to combat it while they're trying to do their job. You're talking about after the fact, you check the stats and see how things worked out, and then you go back and either, as you said, demote the person, or you notice that women are performing better than they're giving credit for and should be promoted at a faster rate.
Yep. I'm saying part of that, but I'm also saying that if I wasn't aware of my own bias, like, I grew up in a community that had very strong female leads, in my world, right? And I grew up with a relatively non, traditional masculine father. And I, I'm a feminist. And even with that, I am aware that I have a more propensity to interrupt a woman than a man when they're speaking. I see that sometimes. I see it sometimes post the interruption. Sometimes I'm able to catch it before I speak. And so just having that bit of awareness, now what I do is when a woman's speaking in a conference room and I want to say something, I just do not say anything until she's completely done. I won't take that courtesy when a man is speaking. I'll actually interrupt them. I won't stop myself. And that is a conscious decision that takes time and energy. It takes work to do that, but it helps to compensate for my bias and my privilege.
So why don't you avoid interrupting men as well?
Well, because I know that I have a bias of interrupting women, and therefore, if I compensate in that way, I try to balance my bias. Of course, I try not to interrupt people in general, but you know me. I interrupt you all the time. I think the onus is on the person that has the privilege and has the bias to help them be aware of it and to try to compensate for it. Don't
yes.
you think?
Yes, but I think it's also the onus of the companies
yes.
that employ them to do the data analysis to try to figure out where these biases are coming into play.
Yeah, I agree that the post-analysis is extremely important. And that's exactly what Facebook should do at this point. They should go, ooh, we can learn from this. We can work on it. And their public statement was a really bad example. Though what they should have right. said is, this is so cool. Maybe we can actually make an environment that's better for women to work in. And then that's the right PR move to go out there, right? From a marketing perspective of getting women engineers, all of a sudden, oh, wow, Facebook recognized that that was a problem. They're going to try to figure out ways to do it. Hey, invite engineers to come aboard to try to solve this problem.
Mm-hmm. The danger, and this is what I fear from the tone-deaf responses, was that you can always go back and try to say, okay, now we're going to do the data. But if you have the bias and you're not owning up to it, you have the potential to do a whole garbage in, garbage out. You start making the criteria that you're testing on something that is already heavily loaded.
Totally. I can see they could be heavily loaded. It's interesting. I feel like this has I can connect an analogy to safety equipment in the workspace, where if you're building a house, you're a construction crew and you're building, you are required to do certain things like wear steel-toed boots and wear a hard hat. I'm thinking like construction areas, right? Those things are part of requirement of the job. They hamper your movement. Some of these things are designed so that you cannot do certain things. For example, when you're on scaffolding, you're supposed to always keep yourself tethered. So you have a tethering system, so you always keep yourself tethered. And the rule of that environment is to, when you remove one tether, you have to have the other one connected, and then you can switch them. But you always have a tether, and that's so if you make a mistake, you don't die. It seems to me that those systems in place are setting up a pattern of success of not dying. And they are protecting you from your mistake.
Right.
Right? So that seems like a software system that could help you be aware of your bias and remove your bias is kind of like social safety gear.
Right. And here's the question of where people, the rebuttal to that might be, oh, but no one is dying while they're working at Facebook. No one has a life-threatening situation when they're trying to get their feeds
it's
working
okay,
just right.
It's okay, they're subjugated just a little bit. Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, that's what I'm thinking is the rebuttal. And then the rebuttal to the rebuttal would be, no, the only thing at stake is the ability to have a job that pays so much higher than the national average
right.
that you're basically excluding someone from the life they want to live.
I'm pretty optimistic on us getting better at this kind of thing. I feel like the dialogue lately has been, look at this horrible bias that exists. Look at this horrible balance point that's wrong. And Facebook, for example, is a great company in a lot of ways where they're they're looking at the world and how the world communicates with each other and trying to make that better.
After kicking and screaming and saying they weren't for a long time. But yeah, that's a whole other.
But I mean, I think there are some really wonderful people at Facebook thinking about hard problems.
Sure.
And I am sure that a lot of engineers at the company saw this article and went, well, what can we do to make this better? How can we solve this problem? And they'll stumble and they'll fail and they'll get better at it, I hope. And my optimistic side is that they'll actually achieve a culture of, you know, bias noticing and change that goes in the right direction. I mean, compensating for our own bad qualities as human beings should be one of those ideal goals. It's like the core of religion. It's the core of most philosophies. You know, we're flawed. We try to work to get better. Do these things that will help you get better. And we're just getting more clarity on those kind of personal problems that we have and what they look like as bad qualities in society and how to address them. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know the Geek said hello. The theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the air and with me is Mr. Miles Elam. I also want to thank our patron supporters. You can learn more about supporting the show and helping spread the word of this program up at geekspeak.org/support. Miles, thank you so much for being on air with me.
Always a pleasure.
This week's episode was episode 16 of season 17, Billboard Radiation Pulls Handbrake on Antivirus Jobs. Thanks, Greg, for the title. I had this experience today where someone had a whole bunch of messy logs, and inside the messy logs was some numbers and some test numbers that he needed. And he's like, I need these numbers. And he was kind of in a rush. And he's like, there's a regex to get these out, right? I'm like, yeah. And he had a text editor that had a regex search and replace. And so I was like, what do you, you know? And so I did a search real quick for 4 digits with a colon after it because it looked like the fastest pattern in regex. And that was easy, you know, /D/D/D. I didn't even do like 4 or whatever in the brackets. And I got the match. And he was like, no, but then if you replace those, then what about? I was like, oh, you want inverse of that so that you can delete everything else that's not that. And okay. And so then I was like, bracket, caret, you know. And I'm like, I realized that in helping someone else, my regex skills are fine. I mean, the only thing I ever use it for is searching. Like, that's all I ever use.
You don't put it into product. Okay.
I don't ever put it in product because you don't really want a situation where you, unless you're doing like
users
language analysis.
Users aren't putting regex into the search bar.
But yeah, right. And also, you know, regex is not like it's not like I'm, you know, in the client code and I get a list of movies back and I go, ooh, I need to find the title field and I do a regex across the JSON data or something. That would be insane, right? So we structure all our data a lot more than that. We never really need regexes for that kind of stuff. But for search and replace of log files and things of that nature, it's always useful to have them. And I just banged it. The thing that was interesting is that I did it quick for someone else on someone else's machine, understood why the patterns weren't doing, had a couple requests of me, changed it on the fly, got exactly what they wanted, and then walked away. And it was really quick. And I went, oh, I know regex really well. When you have a complicated thing like regex and you're using it, you go, wait, well, how do I do this pattern repeated second time where it's not of the first? You know, it's like something complicated where you go outside your boundary zone, you're like, and then you're like doing some research trying to figure it out, and you finally figure it out. So you feel like you're kind of always failing. The stuff that you know really well, that never takes time, so you don't think about it, right? So it's kind of neat to see where when you're an expert on something, you never think of yourself as an expert on something. What is that pattern called?
Dunning-Kruger. Someone who doesn't know much about it thinks that they are far more skilled, and the people who are skilled don't think they know as much. It's funny you were talking about regex, and like I don't put it in the product. I just do it every once in a while, and I was just thinking, I use regex daily.
For doing what?
For doing GeekSpeak. All the stuff I've been doing for GeekSpeak, like, I use it.
What do you
use regex for? I don't even mean daily.
What
I
do you mean
just like the locations in Nginx are regular expressions.
What locations?
For location matches. The URIs.
Oh,
season,
yeah.
Episode.
Yeah. So what you're saying is when you're writing the Nginx conf file, configuration file, you're using regex for the pattern matchers because,
yes,
of course, that's what they are. But we don't have complicated ones in GeekSpeak. Oh, but they're now matching script points. Like, that is actually your router. Nginx has the router in it.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So, but I mean, it's matching the URI. It's matching, so it had to do season, episode, you know, matches.
Oh, dude, you should look at the Ruby on Rails route file for GeekSpeak. It's a freaking mess. It's not regex.
Yeah. I just did a regex to simulate server-side includes, just so it was the same syntax as what is commonly out there.
Nerd.
And so I have a regex for that. So I now know how to not just make a regex, but a regex that escapes cleanly in Lua.
So let me ask you, is this, when does the regex get turned into machine code, if you will? Is it like, is it running in Lua?
Sorry? A regex get returned
meaning,
in machine
meaning
code.
Meaning, I understand that regexes are very slow to process. When you're doing
as compared to what?
As opposed to stepping through a structured data structure. So what you're saying is you have a regex on every request coming in to match these files, to match your patterns, right?
Yes.
You don't think that's a problem?
No.
Why is that not a problem?
The alternative is a static location, so listing every season and episode manually, just hard code it in there. You need a pattern.
A regex engine, though, the thing that processes regular expressions, mm-hmm. is going to have more complexity to it than a more structured system. Like, you don't need to do a whole bunch of stuff when you're just matching a pattern.
You are using the word structured in a really odd way. It's throwing me off.
Okay. So if you say statically map the first part of the URL that says, okay, anything that's episode and then a slash and a slash and a slash, that structure, you're splitting on slashes and then you're looking at the array and then you grab the first array and that's the year and the second array is the second array entry is
the right entry. Yeah, okay.
Right. So like, so our data
the first
structure
match, the first match would be season, second match would be episode, but yeah.
The current URL structure is what I think about. Episode, sure. Year, month, day is the URL structure for mm-hmm. the GeekSpeak site. And so if you just take that string and you split off of the forward slash, then your index zero is the application route, if you will, episodes, and the next one is the year value, the next one's the month value, and so on. Now you have array pointers to look up, and you can change those into ints, and then you've got your match in the database. Mm-hmm. Rather than a regular expression thing that would be just a regex to match that same pattern, the engine to process that is more complex, and therefore it's going to be slower than splitting. Does that make sense? One, you have a character array, you step through the character array, finding those characters and making new entries. The other, you have a regex pattern that could be pretty complicated. So it's going to be slower.
Wait, I guess I'm not understanding what you're saying, because what is your alternative to a regex for detecting the URI that you want to go to?
What do you mean? I just explained it.
But you were talking about just array points in there.
So if the structure, if the URL has a data structure such that the only separation between things is it's a character string, let's ignore byte encoding and all that mm-hmm. stuff right now, and just forward slashes is the delimiter, and after that it is data, you structured the data to match things. I mean, what's the question? Because what you're doing actually is you're going and doing a query against the database, right? So you're building an SQL statement is what's really happening in the back end.
Yes.
My point really has to do with how long it takes to run an execution of creating a regular expression object and then processing that as a regular expression versus this is a character array, I'm going to step through and break this into other characters. It's going to be faster in the latter than the former.
It's going to be faster if you know the exact offsets. If you have, for example, a log file where the offsets are always the same, or a binary format that the offsets are always the same, you can use that array. But otherwise, you need to do some type of pattern matching. Regular expression engines are actually quite optimized for that pattern matching. They may not be as slow as you think.
Yeah, maybe not. That's kind of what I was asking.
If you have backtraces, if you have a whole bunch of conditionals, you know, like the stars, the question marks, so you have to go and check this long thing that has subchecks and then goes, oh, it fails, go back through, yeah. And then run back through. Yeah, that's going to take a while.
So I guess what I'm saying is, when I said when does it get into machine code, what I mean by that is in a Nginx server, when it init's, when it actually starts at the service, it reads its config files, it takes the regex things that we write in that mm-hmm. format, and it transposes that into a more structured form.
Yes.
and that is at init time. So you're not running regular expression on
config
every
file load. Yeah,
yeah, and so you're not running a regular expression in that concept, like a regular expression engine.
No, you are
on
you
every
are.
Request.
You're not compiling the regular expression on every instance.
You're compiling it at start time.
Yes.
Okay. So I guess I don't understand what is a compile time on a regex. I don't actually understand what that really means.
Regexes are not, when I said compile, I mean, that's the terminology used in many APIs to say compile the regex for general use, but you're really parsing it ahead of time and making a syntax tree.
Yeah, so the creation of the syntax tree itself is going to be faster in processing, if you will, than a raw
then yes, I'm making the regexes once, then checking to see if they match multiple times.
What you're doing with a regex when you create the syntax tree is you're making a highly efficient way of matching exactly that pattern.
Right. I'm not dynamically creating my regexes. Right.
I can't send to you a regex that you then instantiate.
No. That is not. No.
Okay. So it's at boot time, if you will.
Yes.
Okay. That's cool.
There is a query language for the full text search, but that is more akin to what you'd expect from typing in a Google search, say this and that, this or that.
Right.
This and not that.
I have to say, Miles, I feel bad. I still have not downloaded your code and run it and tried it.
That's okay. Yeah. It's just the database schema right now. I didn't have the Nginx code isn't up there.
Oh, it isn't?
Try. No.
Oh, okay. I thought the Nginx code was there.
Or maybe it is, but it's an old version.
All right. Well, I just got to say,
no,
I've got
it's a database
so
schema,
many little
just
side
so you can
projects.
Take a look at the database schema just to do
see
a,
if I'm cool with it.
Yeah, do a sanity check. Although I did make some changes since I
do you have
I pulled passwords out of the people table.
Why?
One for security means that now with sessions I can look that up without having a password come into the query. I can have the security for passwords be controlled just by if you call the
a
stored
function.
Procedure.
Yeah.
Then you. Accesses that, but a user would not have.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Or user would not have any access to it.
Oh, what we're saying is wherever the user and password correlation saved that table, just has like a user ID and the password and the salt and such, and the hash, I should say, inside that, and then the user we're actually using has no read capability of that table or write capability. It has to be stored procedures, and the stored procedures take in a clear text password as a check.
Yes.
And then confirm whether it worked or not.
Yes.
Oh, that's really cool. That's a very cool idea.
Except now you have me thinking about doing Google authentication and OAuth authentication. Although I was leaning away from doing Google authentication and leaning more toward GitHub authentication. A, it's geekier, and B, people who would be interested in our site would have a GitHub account, but not necessarily a Google. I mean, that would be a target audience is if you have GitHub.
We're going to have password and GitHub, right? Or we're just going to switch to GitHub?
Well, there's the question. I would only want to do one or the other. I don't know that I want to do both. But it does mean that password is a separate table. So too would be the OAuth token.
The token, yeah.
So there's that. I've added a few more comments, make it easier to read. One of the most important things that I've been trying to do with it is make sure that tables and columns all have a comment associated with it. So if you open it up in pgadmin, for example, that there is a description of what it is you're looking at.
Mm-hmm. So can I give you my excuse of why I haven't worked on that?
Buying a house?
Yeah, I'm buying a house. And my other side project is one of the things I'm kind of half working on is Woz's website, woz.org,
yep.
Steve Wozniak.
Yep.
His website is a Drupal site, and it's version 6. And
so old.
Drupal's version 8 right now.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the way you make Drupal, one of the things you can do is inside the Drupal language, you can make these things called views, which are kind of, they're like database views, if you will, but they're actually HTML views or PHP HTML views that allow you to kind of create on the fly data structures that turn into visualization. And the problem with those is that the syntax changes over the years. So right now, if you go to woz.org, you'll see like a feed of most recent stories, and that's a mix of letters that he's responded to and also news stories responded to. And those also have their own sections. The long and the short of this, though, is when you migrate, you basically have to recreate all of that. And moving away from Drupal would be a lot more painful than staying in Drupal. So what I did recently was copy all the PHP and all the files to my local box and get MySQL running, which is what that system works, not Postgres, which MySQL, actually the user interface is not bad. You should look at the MySQL.
Oh, the user interfaces for MySQL have always been better than Postgres.
Yeah, I mean, you should, since you're doing the PostgreSQL rewrite kind of thing, you should take a look at what they've got. I mean, there was still really that completely frustrating thing is, I've got an admin tool now. It can't connect to the database. Why? Is the database running? Oh, yeah, this isn't the same tool. I can start the database. Start the database. Admin tool connects automatically. Oh, how did it connect automatically? How did it connect automatically and also not was able to start it? What users are running? Like, all the stuff is all of a sudden kind of subjugated from me. Now, of course, it's a dev box. I don't really care if the permissions and stuff are wrong. No one has access to my machine. Mm-hmm. Outside ports aren't on. But still, it was kind of this frustrating thing. And I'm like, I don't have to solve that. All I have to do is migrate. Like, just let that go. It's like when you've got these little projects, when you have an unknown, you kind of want to dive into it. And then you just go into this rat nest of pain. So anyway, I'm migrating that right now. And of course, I asked, like, there's this group called Santa Cruz Geeks, which is a Slack channel now.
I'm in it.
And I went ahead and asked the web dev group, here was Drupal, and who wants to do a little side project that's kind of fun? Because, you know, Woz is cool. And people are like, yeah, I'll do that for 1,000. I'm like, yeah, that's probably fair. I should probably just ask him for money. You know, and I'm not, because it's like Woz, and it's kind of cool. At the same time, it's not like he doesn't have money. It's kind of a silly way of thinking about it. Anyway, so that's why I haven't been doing the GeekSpeak thing, because the side project is that. And work. Okay. Yeah. Have you done an mText parser to what text thing were you using? We use textile still?
I thought we were doing markup. I thought we just said we were doing markup.
So we've got to translate mText to markup and textile to markup.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some pretty complex textile. Have you worked on any of that?
Very briefly. I had bigger fish to fry. So I was going to leave the textile in there for now.
The textile.
Yeah, just leave it as textile. And
render it as textile?
Yeah.
And do you have a textile renderer in Lua?
There is one. I'm working on other things trying to get it up and running.
Okay, that's fine. I just noticed that the Woz site, because I was like, mentioned to someone I was working on the Woz site, and they were like, wait, you work on Woz? I was like, yeah, I've interviewed him too. It was really fun. And then they were like, oh, really? And I went and find the Woz page on our site, which is years ago, and it's like mText, so it doesn't translate well. It just looks like...